Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sue Fraser, and I'd like you to keep eating and eat fast, please. My fellow members of the Press Club Committee have asked me to attend to a few of the items of housekeeping on their behalf before we hear from our guest speaker today. First, I would like to welcome representatives from Telstra and their guests, and to say how pleased that our committee is to have Telstra as a corporate supporter. So thanks are certainly in order, please. Also to Qantas for making available the air ticket for our guest speaker, as they always do. Thank Qantas, please. Now, if you're attending for the first time today and you'd like to be on our mailing list, ask Tony O'Brien to include you or any one of the committee. And, of course, the committee is made up of the news directors and editors of the various media outlets. So speak to any one of those people and we'll put you on our mailing list. As usual, to balance the books, we have our $2 raffle tickets that are on the table. So pop your $2 in there. We need to keep ourselves in the black. And we have some goodies for you today. A gift pack from Telstra, which is a nice desk clock, and two tickets to the sensational Gumboot Dancers of Soweto, who are coming here. Samela Harris, the former arts editor of the Advertiser, she's just had a big promotion, tells me that it's a great show. Sarah, it's a great show, isn't it? It's famous, she says. So Telstra have provided us with those tickets, which is some hand clapping and boot slapping at the Festival Centre, which is next Thursday night. We also have some cartons of beer from SA Brewing. Thank you to SA Brewing, and you're drinking their beer today. I also have some family passes for the latest Eddie Murphy movie, which is a comedy called Dr. Dolittle. And I'd like to thank our old friend and movie promoter, John Cronin, for giving us those family passes to Dr. Dolittle. We have a $50 voucher from the Red Ochre Grill. Now, the Red Ochre Grill, in case you don't know, have moved to new premises. They're now at Ebenezer Place at the East End off Rundle Street, native Australian cuisine, so look up the Red Ochre Grill. We've got that $50 voucher. And Francine Connor today just came over and handed me some honorary members' tickets to the 1998 Royal Adelaide Show, which is only 91 days to go to the show, she tells me. So we have some tickets too, so pop your $2 in, it's worth it. I'd also like to tell you that the Youth Media Awards will be announced on Wednesday, the 10th of June. So put that date in your diary. Media releases will be issued for that, the Youth Media Awards on Wednesday, the 10th of June. Just a moment. Tony keeps telling me the tickets are $2 each for the raffle. Please make sure that your mobile phone is turned off as a courtesy to our guest speaker, if you have a mobile phone. And will you now welcome the President of the South Australian Press Club, Don Riddell. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. Good heavens, the place is full of controversial newspaper editors, controversial ex-newspaper editors, controversial reporters, people of controversial Adelaide, controversial clowns and jugglers, even controversial mummers and mountebanks. Today should be fun. Our guest today, however, is much more than a provocative phrase. He is very much part of the outspoken, an occasionally outrageous tradition of Australian newspapers that go back to Archibald and the pink pages of the Bulletin, the Nortons, the Packers, the Murdochs. What a tribe. Piers Ackerman has worked for The Australian, Newsday and The West Australian. He was foreign editor of The Times, I think, when he got a phone call on a Thursday to say that he had to be in Adelaide to be editor of The Advertiser on Monday. Adelaide? The Advertiser? Could life be the same again? And in a couple of years, he gave us a lot of fun, a little pain, and some shrewd judgments. Since then, he's taken this rambunctious style to the Sun Herald in Melbourne, to Fox Television and station WTTG in the United States, and he now writes a gentle and instructive column for the Telegraph in Sydney. I've no idea what he can talk about. Oh, sorry, one thing. Whatever else he may be, Piers Ackerman is a newspaper man, and for that I forgive him a lot. I've got no idea what he's going to talk about, but I know, like you, I can't wait to find out. Ladies and gentlemen, Piers Ackerman.
They do have sloping podiums, and they should have a little rest for a red, because I think that we'll need one. First of all, I want to say from the heart how wonderful it is to be invited to come to this forum, and how impressed I am by the Adelaide Press Club. I gather from Bob Main, who picked me up at the airport, it's now been going 2 or 3 years. I just wish it was something that existed when I was down here, because it clearly is the preeminent opportunity to exchange views from people from a broad section of the community with those who work in the media, and not just the print media, the people from the advertisers, but also the television and radio. And all too rare are these opportunities today. And I'm pleased to see a number of people from other areas of the Adelaide business here. And I hope that when they look around and see the editors, the news editors, the radio and television, they understand that this is designed to provide some exchange and interflow, because editors need to hear from their readers at every strata of the society. Because without readers or listeners or viewers, there is no communications industry. And I think that this forum, Don, provides just a fantastic meeting place for those things. And the speakers that you've had in the past obviously attract those people. There are a couple of things that I would like to say about South Australia, apart from the fact that I and my family obviously enjoyed our period down here enormously. In fact, my younger daughter was almost in tears when I told her she couldn't accompany me here today, as this remains her most favourite home in the 6 or 7 she's had in her 13 years. But and I still have my, in Sydney anyway, legendary dog Max, who came from the Sandy Creek Dog Home and has been with us in Melbourne, London, Washington, and is now with us still in Sydney, aging 10. And I promised Peter Lehman that when Max expires, that I won't have him stuffed, but I'll bring him down and plant him under one of those roses at the end of a long line of Shiraz vines. But I'll put him in a suitcase. I'm not going to buy a ticket for a dead dog. I do have what I think is a very important message today, and that is about Pauline Hanson. I want to say it, and I want to say it here, knowing that there are other media people in the room, and I hope that they'll take this message away with them and think about it and maybe even editorialise about it later on. Our major political parties are untiredly scrambling to find some intelligent response to this alarming surge in Pauline Hanson's personal popularity as we go into the final week of the Queensland state election. To date, their strategy has been to launch savage, ugly, and gratuitous personal attacks upon this Ipswich independent. I believe they'll only further polarise the community and probably propel more people into her camp. The insertion of this sneering smear, along with a hefty dollop of political bias, is the natural game of most of the self-appointed elites who've been dictating Australia's political agenda for the past 30 years. It's been institutionalised by generations of ABC interviewers, such as, well known that former ABC personnel, Stuart Littlemore, Bill Peach, both wrote in their memoirs about their own activities to sway the news and present their own bias. It's also the mainstay of commentary by such intellectually confused Fairfax columnists as the ever-erratic Gerard Henderson. But calling Pauline Hanson deranged, as John Howard did earlier this week, with the support of Kim Beazley, won't suit and satisfy these louche lounge sweet liberals, and it won't have any impact on her die-hard supporters. The unprecedented and absolutely un-Australian outpouring of abuse that greeted Pauline Hanson when she first came into public attention 2.5 years ago may have made her look like a rabbit caught in a spotlight, but there were some unpleasant truths contained in her naive utterances that had not previously been discussed because of the censorial political correctness that dictated the topics of general debate. And that's the reality. Her naive readiness to speak out on such themes as racism, multiculturalism, and immigration challenged the official silences endured because of the censorial culture created by the thought police who've reigned in Canberra, Melbourne, and Sydney particularly, since the days of the Whitlam government. She asked the awkward questions others had been too frightened to ask. She questioned the policies most were too afraid to question. And for this, she was pilloried without intelligent response by her critics. Sure, her questions were often crowded, surrounded, and submerged in the most extreme propaganda coming from the most egregious fringe groups of Australian politics. But they were there, and she was a democratically elected representative. She did struggle to articulate the dissatisfaction and disillusionment she felt, and that felt by many others. And her remarks resonated with a wide audience of ordinary Australians. Poor rural families across Australia do ask why they have to save to afford special perks for their children, such as holidays to the coast, when such extras are government-funded for young Aboriginals. The UN Draft Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples does provide a blueprint for the division of this country into a number of nation states to be governed by Aboriginal Australians. Mike Mansell's Aboriginal Provisional Government has the stated goal of establishing an Aboriginal state, which would, and I quote, essentially be Crown land, but in addition there would be some land which would be needed by the Aboriginal community other than Crown land. And this was stated in a speech delivered in August 1990. Titled Aboriginal Sovereignty. And that being done, the document went on to explain that in exchange for Aboriginal people giving up perhaps half of the country to white Australians, there would still be need for a compensation package. And in February 1994, in a paper titled Seeking Real Rights for the Aboriginal People of Australia, the Provisional Government, which issues its own passports, outlined its desire to take all the money the Australian government receives from the Crown lands and royalty payments, lease payments and company taxes. It amounted then to approximately $6 billion annually. And it also wished to retain the more than $2 billion that Aboriginal Affairs puts out in its budget. 2 years ago, at a conference at James Cook University, the Labor historian Henry Reynolds, who was the principal architect and driving force behind the campaign to enforce the findings of Mabo on the mainland, did discuss with Mick Dodson the tactics required to bring about an Aboriginal nation using the forces of the United Nations. Now, anybody who saw Mrs. Hanson's recent appearance on Ray Martin's program will readily agree that she still looks stupid, particularly when asked to explain her positions. The reality is that she has brought sharply into focus the question of the freedom of speech in this country. I believe that those who were in the forefront of the blunt and oafish media attacks upon her initially should have thought more deeply about such a freedom before they attempted their clumsy demolition jobs. They should have concentrated their attention on dissecting her policies, or the lack of them, or given a bit of time to examining those who surround her, not excluding the appalling David Oldfield, the only person I know who is on the public record as spending 70 minutes on some sort of oral sex telephone program and asking the federal government to pick up the check. According to a Senate Estimates Committee Hansard, which I was reading yesterday, he is now repaid $990. John Howard was probably correct in his initial assessment and approach to Mrs. Hanson. But regrettably, his opponents used their campaign against her as a savage cudgel to wield against him, and they weren't going to let that opportunity slip by. If there had been greater discussion about the topics Mrs. Hanson raised prior to her emergence, and immediately subsequent, she probably wouldn't have a leg to stand on now. But unfortunately, our elites, who plagiarized their outmoded political correctness from American academia, are not that smart. Had they been, they would have noted a decade ago that this culture is on its way out, not only in the US but globally. They're backing a loser. Just last weekend, Californians voted to rescind bilingual education against in their state. This was done against the wishes of the bureaucrats, the major party candidates, and those intent on entrenching Spanish as the secondary language in that state. You can see that the Hispanic industry was lobbying to have all children taught in Spanish primarily and English secondarily. That scenario would be familiar to everybody in Australia who's been watching the manner in which representatives of the Aboriginal lobby and ethnic industries in this country operate. Now, I want to stress that I firmly believe that those people who are at the top end, the pointy end, of Aboriginal affairs in this country are out of touch with the average Aboriginal Australian who believes in a fair go. The Anglo and Hispanic parents in California clearly felt that the existing system of bilingualism was condemning their children to live in some linguistic limbo, and they rejected correctly that politically correct route. John Howard, from the instant his government took office, I believe, started dismantling this framework. He moved to look at the rorts which had existed within the Immigration Department and tighten the restrictions on bringing in unskilled workers to stack branches in marginal electorates. He looked at the ability of new immigrants to come into the country and draw down upon the benefits that Australian taxpayers were paying for. He looked at the question of multiculturalism as a divisive force and felt that inasmuch as the Anglo culture was the predominant culture in this country, that families were predominant force and remain the predominant force, that these were values that were worth supporting. I tend to believe that he's correct. Since the departure of Paul Keating, Mr. Beazley, however, I believe, has retreated into a 50s and 60s perception of the way Australian culture should develop. I think this is a very sad intellectual departure from the political scene. But what I wish to say last, before questions, is that I don't believe Mrs. Hanson deserves a vote. I called her office the other day and asked for a copy of her manifesto to be sent to me. She doesn't have one. I asked for an outline of the broad platform of her views. It hasn't been compiled. I asked what her thoughts on health, education, unemployment, future of the Australian economy. Sorry, they said, we don't have any of those things. So what I would urge the media people in this room to convey through their editorials, but not through their news columns, unlike the ABC, is not to vote for One Nation, but do try to instruct your readers, listeners, and viewers why this person has been accorded such a high profile in the Australian political scenario, and why a vote should not be wasted on this party in the Queensland elections or in the federal elections later this year. And Don, I want to thank you for giving me a soapbox to stand on to make this this point, which I think is probably one of the most important that I've ever been able to make in my 30 years in journalism.
See, I told you it was a pussycat. Now I'll take questions from the media first, and with all questions, please, you must state which organisation you represent and ask a question, not state your position. I know Christopher Pearson is aching to ask the first question. Hold on,
Christopher Pearson, the Adelaide Review. Piers, I want to draw your attention to two phenomena and ask you perhaps to comment on them in the light of your speech. The first is the Sydney Morning Herald journalist Paul Sheehan's runaway bestseller, 30,000 copies sold in a week. Its main theme, the book's called Among the Barbarians, its main theme that there have been aching chasms of silence in Australian journalism caused by journalistic neglect of the hard issues and preoccupation of political correctness. The second is closer to home. I think perhaps half the people in this room are aware that there's been an enormous Barney going on behind closed doors, with Charlie Perkins claiming to be a member of the Stolen Generation, and the family that took him into their care resentfully trying to clear their name of accusations of genocide, a subject that everyone so far has been too timid to deal with.
Well, to deal with Sheehan's book, interestingly, I became aware around March, April last year that Paul Sheehan had an article that he had prepared on Asian crime in Cabramatta, particularly Cabramatta, that he had given to his editors at the Sydney Morning Herald, and they were sitting on and not running. I wrote an article about this suppression within the opposition newspaper. Now, it's not my job to promote their writers or circulation, but shortly after that, I received a call from a furious Sheehan who said that I had embarrassed him enormously, as the topic was of a severe embarrassment to him, but he really didn't wish the internal wars of the Herald to be public. The reality was that the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald did not wish to run a story on Asian crime. That feud in Fairfax was the genesis of his book. The paper felt that it was inappropriate, which is one of those great weasel words often used, it was inappropriate to highlight the fact that the drug trade in Sydney and Cabramatta was controlled by a particular ethnic group. Sheehan was so incensed by this that he asked the police if they had any other breakdowns, and he found a crime for almost every ethnic group within the community, including Anglos, Irish, Turks, and God knows, it didn't matter. But apparently there is a tray, or there is a particular crime that we all like to commit. Now, I don't know what what the particular breakdown makeup in Adelaide is, and it may be different. But in his book, he explains what the statistics show there. On the second point, and thank you for that question, because I think it goes back to something which I noted very early on during the Hindmarsh Island debate here, and that was that the South Australian ABC was particularly exclusive in its coverage, and I think it's widely known now that they were wrong. They misnamed the older women of the Narrangeri group who were saying that there was no secret women's business down in the Murray River mouth near Goolwa. And we now know, that, of course, that this became part of a feminist anthropological agenda at the university here. And we've now seen through two royal commissions that it was a fabrication. But it was not just the ABC. I think the Australian was also guilty of this. The reporters involved, perhaps, or maybe it was instruction from editorial supervisors, that's not clear, but they did not wish to publicise the alternate case. And I think that they abrogated their responsibility in terms of every journalistic code of ethics by not presenting both sides of a debate fairly. And that wounded me enormously, because I'm a great believer in journalistic integrity. But it took a lot of money and a lot of time, a lot of taxpayers' money, and a lot of needless time for that situation to be resolved. With the Charlie Perkins thing, the Sydney Morning Herald 3 years ago ran an article by Deborah Jobson in which Charlie talked about, and I know him very well, being given up by his mother, Hetty, same name as his daughter, in Alice Springs in the late 40s, I think 48, to the Reverend Smith, who ran a home in Alice, but who was looking to move to Adelaide and felt that he had room for 6 young people to come with him. According to the documents, which are freely available, Smith was approached by Mr. Perkins' mother. Perkins said in the article, however, that Smith made her an offer she couldn't refuse. The offer was education and accommodation in Adelaide. He now feels that he is legitimately part of the stolen generation. I think this is wrong. But what I've been looking for is for an Adelaide news outlet to look into this. Because the Reverend Smith's wife, who was a friend of Mr. Perkins' mother, is still alive, albeit she's 84. His son is still alive. But more importantly, four of the other 5 boys who came down initially from Alice Springs to Adelaide are also still alive. Now, I think it's very important for the record to be set straight. But I'd like it to be done to restore the integrity of the Adelaide media by somebody from within the South Australian community. Thank you.
Rex Jury?
Rex Jury, Adelaide Advertiser.
I
love you dearly, Pete. I've got two totally unrelated questions. First of all, would you consider settling out of court the compensation claim that Andrew Short and I are going to raise against you for the terror that Max subjected me to in your period here. And did you know that that bloody dog nearly ended our friendship?
Well, he's the best judge of character I've ever met.
And secondly, during your period here, did you make any mistakes? And if you had your time over again, would you do anything different?
Well, I could allow that question.
Well, I've made heaps of mistakes. And I think that one of the great mistakes that anybody coming to Adelaide will inevitably fall into is even thinking that they understand South Australia. So predicated on that base, everything that flows from there was marginally in error. What really assisted me, however, were the South Australians who, over time, came to be my friends. And, Rex, you're in there. Max loves you now. But I'd like to remind some people of the project which I still look at in hindsight with a great fondness, and that was the Adelaide Vines project. When after a lunch with drinks, not even a lunch, with Philip White, Peter and Margaret Lehman, and a couple of bottles of wonderful, tall bottles of Coopers in the room we used for editorial conferences at the Advertiser. We thought that it would be a very good thing if we could use backyard grapes to make a wine that people may or may not wish to serve, but they could certainly present as something that they grew on their own block, get rid of all the unwanted grapes, and there might be a quid in it for the charity that looked after indigent folk who were then inhabiting the square with altogether too much frequency. And we did it for a couple of years, and it grew and it grew, and I loved going down to the parkland and seeing nuns on bicycles and the governor with his rolls opening the trunk up and pulling these garbage bags of rotting muscatel out and getting the ampelographers, that's a great word, down from Roseworthy. They're the guys who can tell what variety a wine is by the shape of the leaf. They used to come down and tell people what, in fact, that the grapevine that somebody had smuggled in their great-grandmother's knickers from Romania or the outer Tuscany, in fact, was. But we used to troop in a caravan up to Tanunda and have a wonderful day with the band and make grog, and then we all sold it back to these people. And it made, I think, the last receipts I was sent, it made around $60,000. And it was all done gratis, it was all love, and it was wonderful, and that really symbolised, I think, the spirit of South Australia. And I think that one of the great things about Adelaide, because of its isolation, is that it is a community that cares very much about itself. Now, this can also be a bad thing, but when you have a project like that brings brings everybody together, it's like getting behind the state football team. It's like putting SA first. And things change. It's like Keith Conlon and Fritz and what was the State Bank.
Mike Smithson.
Thank you, Don. Piers Mike Smithson from Channel 7. Now, I've never had the pleasure of working for you, but since 11 o'clock this morning, I've spoken to four different people who said, "What are you doing for lunch today?" And I said that I was coming along to hear you speak, which I was looking forward to. And all four of them, their instant reaction was, oh, shit.
Well, because they couldn't get a seat, huh?
Touché, quite possibly. But I've spoken to a lot of people over many years who have worked for you, and a lot of their reactions have been, oh, shit, with the greatest respect, of course. But I'm just wondering, what is it about you as a boss that made you so special with staff who work for you?
Mike, I'm trying to remember the last guy who walked into my office and said, with respect, oh, shit. But his or her name eludes me. I can't think of people who've ever worked for me. I've got to tell you, I can only think of people who've worked with me. There may have been, over the 30 years I've been in the game, people who thought they were working for me, but I've only recognised the ones who were working alongside and had their eyes on the same goal. Now, maybe some of them didn't see the same end reward. Maybe they didn't. And to me, the experience of being in the game is 80% of the reward. The other 20% is at the end of the day when you think you've put out a great addition. I don't have a lot of time for people who feel that they're doing a job for somebody. Maybe that explains the disenchantment that you've experienced.
Robert Mayne?
Robert Mayne from the Bulletin, Piers. One tough one and one free kick. How did Pauline Hanson get on the list of the 100 most sexy women in Australia? And the free kick is, how did you let Ronnie Biggs get away to South America? You can just tell us.
How did I get, what was the second one?
How did you let Ronnie Biggs get away to South America? You know what I mean.
Oh, Ronnie Biggs. I would imagine that Pauline Hanson was voted the 100th sexiest woman in Australia by that rump who enjoys savage beatings. And I'm sure there is some Anglo schoolboy element, the thread that runs. Oh, don't sue me, don't take me to the Human Rights Commission for discrimination against them, for Christ's sake. But now, Ronnie Biggs, I interviewed twice in South America. And as rogues go, he's one of the more entertaining. I'd far rather have a cachaça, which is a rum-based drink, and the drinks they make are named after automobile crashes. You order, I think it's a one-car crash or a three-car crash. And they put a lime in the bottom of the glass with a bit of sugar, and they pound the lime, and then they pour rum over it. It's a top drink. And that, anyway, but he introduced them to me.
Very good, but you were working for Newsday when Newsday ran the story about Ronnie Biggs being in Melbourne. Do you remember?
I do. And I think Jack Darmody, God bless his soul, was a day behind when he put his formidable shoulder to the door and crashed into the empty apartment. Ron had been working as a baggage handler at Essendon in those days, and I think had taken a ship and was having his face rearranged on the en voyage.
Piers, Diana Carroll, Warburton Media Monitoring. Two questions, Piers. One, as somebody who has to listen to and watch every word that our media utters, there has been nothing like the hysteria surrounding Pauline Hanson.
Sorry, I don't understand that. What?
The hysteria that we've seen surrounding Pauline Hanson in terms of the media coverage. I mean, it's just been outrageous, as you obviously appreciate. There is surely an argument that when she was elected to federal parliament, she was one of some 30 new members, and that had the media not given her maiden speech, that enormous coverage, that she would now be some obscure member for a seat in Queensland and we would be none the wiser, and that therefore she is a media creation. I would like your thoughts on that. And I would also like your thoughts on Stuart Littlemore, who addressed this gathering and received quite a reception. And I think that you probably have some thoughts.
That's three questions. Mr. Pitt, make sure she pays extra.
Well, two and a half.
I think that the reason that... and I agree with you. I think the reason that Hanson was given such a huge leg up by the media when she came in was entirely due to the fact that the Canberra Press Gallery had not anticipated, up until the last moment, a Howard victory. Paul Keating, that wonderful wizard of Treasury and Finance, had so cast his cape over these clowns in Canberra that they believed every word he said. Keating didn't believe himself. He knew that he wasn't going to get up. The polls told him so. But the gallery was committed to a course. They could not believe that the person they had nicknamed the Sydney Morning Herald, they call him on the back page, it was something appalling. It was the smart aleck and the dope or the runt or something like this. But it was a most derogatory put down of a political leader. Nevertheless, anybody who had a sense of the Australian electorate would have realised the deep disquiet, the profound uncomfortableness with the vision that Keating had for Australia that far leapfrogged anything ordinary Australians were interested in. After the result, and I went to Howard's first press conference, the gallery was dumbfounded. They were gobsmacked. They looked like they'd been whacked around by Tanduka. They were sitting in the bleachers, and they couldn't even stand when the new Prime Minister walked into the room. I, in my time, have never seen common civility put aside such a mark of disrespect to a new Prime Minister a day after on the morning of a declaration of the poll. Nevertheless, they proceeded from that point. They didn't believe the pallet. They didn't wish to understand the result. And when Pauline Hanson was resurrected as a cudgel with which to beat John Howard's prime ministership, and if you look at the coverage, and I doubt whether any of our left-leaning media institutes will ever do so, but if you analyse the first 3 months, you will see that there are very few stories about John Howard putting his policies in and preparing the groundwork for legislation. They're all about why doesn't he rebuke Pauline Hanson. Well, the reality is that they tossed her out of the Liberal Party in December, 4 months before the election. I actually don't want a Prime Minister to run around picking on independents, don't belong to your party, have no relevance to your party, and shouldn't have any relevance to national politics, because their one vote is pretty meaningless. Nevertheless, that elite, which had been hugged by Keating, which had been to Hayden's Yarralumla, which enjoyed the dinners at the lodge, they thought they were on the inside. Why, I don't know. Because every time they got something wrong or probably half right, Keating would be on the phone abusing them up and down the street, and they came back for more. Talk about masochistic. Anyway, these people felt that they'd been dudded in the election and they weren't going to let John Howard run his prime ministership, so they used Hanson as a weapon against him. Now, as far as Stuart goes, I think he's the most amusing bloke, and quite frankly, I'm a bit sorry that he's off the television. Because I was one of the few people who actually took the time to read his memoirs, And what a farrago of nonsense. I've just reviewed the independent, or former independent, Phil Cleary's memoir for the Sunday Herald Sun in Melbourne, and they'll send me a handsome cheque, no doubt. Unlike Mr. Sullivan, a cheque I'm still waiting for. Recent story he lifted. Acknowledgements don't pay the rent. But little more, and it's worth reading his memoir, just as it's worth reading Bill Peach's, because both of them give you a fascinating insight into how people within the ABC view their organisations and the culture of those organisations. And they see their role in there as arbiters of social constants and deliverers of social justice. Now, their views may well be different from those who pay their salaries. And they are. Fortunately, in Mr. Littlemore's case, a number of people mentioned in his book came forward with statutory declarations and affidavits, not only court records, to prove that he was incorrect. I published them, of course, and heard no more from Stewie. There are too many stations and we could cut its budget. We could lose Triple Jerk Radio without a blink. I don't want them telling my children how to do this and that and where to score drugs, quite frankly. I'm totally sincere. But they do have a function. And in terms of agricultural crop prices and broadcasting federal parliament, I think that there is a role. But, and I'm saying this for Margaret, who listens to... but I would hate to see the ABC disappear. I am concerned. I think that there is a role for them to look at better policing, and I would like to see an outside disciplinary force brought in. I think it's, you know, no point having an ABC review board reviewing their own calumnies. I don't think we'll see that under Donald McDonald's chairmanship nor Brian Jones' stewardship. I think that they need balance. They need integrity and they need ethics. And I think it's a big ask, but it may come. May come.
Why don't you say what you mean?
Beating around the bush again.
Sorry, Piers Ackerman, but Mignon Ellicott, a former ABC journalist.
Miss Ellicott, I know who you are.
Last night I attended a chamber music recital at Elder Hall. Walking from King William Street along North Terrace, I passed far more Asians than Australians. I gather from your opinion that you agree with Pauline Hanson that the Australian government has been far too generous in its immigration laws relating to Asia. Could I have your opinion?
Well, in fact, you're wrong. I think that at the moment, with the meltdown in Asia, we have an opportunity to pick the cream of the intelligentsia and the business community. And I would like to see the high flyers, people who have had their own successful businesses in places like Hong Kong, which is now under the hand of mainland China, I'd like to think that we can offer them a home down here to help reinvigorate some of our industries and to start operations. What I don't wish to see, however, is the appalling wholesale shipping in, the importing of people with no skills, no education, no will to work, who culturally believe that welfare is an entitlement that they have to hook onto, to leech into as soon as they arrive in the country. I think that we are still a vastly underpopulated land. The Democrats and I disagree with that. They think that we've reached the level or limits of our population growth. I think that they're totally wrong. I think that this country will wither and suffer unless we bring vigorous, new ideas and people who have and exhibit the same drive, the same desires as our own forebears did when they made often perilous voyages in small boats across the seas.
Right, two more questions. There's one over here and one over here.
Piers, Ray Wood from Professional Public Relations. You urge the newspapers to use their editorial columns against, what's her name, from Queensland. How much influence do you think newspaper editorial columns actually have on moulding public opinion?
I think they have a lot on legislators. I don't think, I mean, every survey you ever do, it just shows how we all lie. Every survey you ever do, you ask people, what do you read in the paper? They all wish to be thought they're extremely bright and erudite. And they say, oh, I read the editorial first. And you, in fact, know they read the sports page and then they looked at the weather. But I do believe that people in Canberra look to see what's said in the editorial because they think that just as a fish rots from the head down, so the drift of the organisation will flow from that authority. And the perception of their particular party may well mirror the indicators that show up in the leader column.
One over here, is it Brad?
Piers, I'm just interested in, as a clown of the press gallery during the Hawke, Keating and up to Howard era that you mentioned before, I'm interested in your role of editors during that era. There seems to be a rewriting of history suggesting that people in the Canberra press gallery made their own decisions about what would go to print. Surely editors had a pretty vital role in what was accepted from the gallery, what was directed to be written, and then what went to the public. What's your view on what was allowed to go to print?
Well, don't bleed in public, Brad, but I think it's a very, very good question. And I think you're right. I think that the editors around Australia must keep far closer contact with their Canberra bureaus. I can't speak for my colleagues. I've always made a practice, though, to try and bring the Canberra people through the office as often as possible so that they can experience what the people in the readership area are thinking, so they don't get trapped in the Canberra mindset, which you know is very easy to do, and you see it all around you. Certainly the Prime Ministers you mentioned were excellent at duchessing editors. And, I freely acknowledge that I had a couple of excellent bottles of Grange with Keating in his little office there. Well, it was a terrific night. And he told me so much scandal about everybody in his front bench and every Labour Premier in the country. And I said, God, is that what he really thinks about these people? And he did, of course. But I was never a captive. And I think that that's the difference.
It's 2:00. Thank you very much indeed, Piers Ackerman. I'm glad to see you're timid to the end.